this hour, China launches large-scale military drills around Taiwan, one day after the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to the island, which has infuriated Beijing. The Bank of England unleashes its biggest interest rate hike in 27 years, as it warns the U.K. is heading for more than a year of recession amid soaring inflation. And official data show that at least 700 people have fallen victim to police brutality in the U.S. in the first 7 months of 2022, the highest than any other year on record. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Taiwan. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. China has launched its largest ever military exercises around Taiwan, after a visit to the self-ruled island by the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The maneuvers feature live fire, sea, and air drills in multiple areas around Taiwan. The drills are taking place at some points as close as 20 kilometers from the island. The exercises kicked off on Tuesday and are slated to conclude next Sunday. The drills have drawn a strong reaction from Taiwan. It said that China fired multiple ballistic missiles into waters around Taiwan, condemning what it described as irrational actions that undermine peace. Taiwan also said that it will, quote, uphold the principle of preparing for war without seeking war. Andrew Loing is an independent China specialist who joins us. Welcome. You know, when you take a look at what the U.S. accomplished here, it pales in comparison to the destruction that it has incurred when it comes to peace, to stability, and just ramping up tensions in that area. There's no other way of looking at it. How do you see the visit, and more importantly now, the way that China has reacted to it? In your view, is it an appropriate response?
Well, I think that you've got to understand that this is not happens all of a sudden by itself. It is the result of a very serious provocation in the form of Nancy Pelosi's visit, in spite of warnings in advance by the Chinese president, President Xi, in talks, direct talks with President Biden, saying that this is really the red line because Nancy Pelosi is the second in line to succeed the presidency. The One China policy is now has been consistently being followed out by the United States by getting more senior officials to visit Taiwan as if it's an independent country, in spite of the policy United States is supposed to adhere to, and also creating lots of more diplomatic and other type play in international organizations, including those under the United Nations. If Beijing is not careful, then Taiwan would become a virtual separate country, and that would be against the wishes of Beijing, but also the entire People's Republic of China, a fifth of mankind, actually. Almost 99% of them want unification. But the reality is that most Taiwanese people do not want unification, nor do they want independence because they will threaten their livelihood. All they want is status quo. But then the status quo can only be maintained if there is a genuine belief in Beijing that the One China policy is being honored. But now, the United States as Nancy Pelosi is poking China in the arm, calling China's bluff, as it were. So what do you expect China to do? Turning the other cheek? So it's not realistic. And hence, as predicated by this very stern warning, the apparent lack of immediate response already sparked off huge kind of clamor in social media in China, saying that, you warned the United States not to do this. Now they've done this deliberately. So we should really react. And there's a kind of groundswell of clamor directed to the Chinese Communist Party. So that's China has got to react as promised. And so it's conducting all these military exercises, both within 100 miles away from Taiwan, and also more provocatively conducting a surrounding and circling kind of military exercises in terms of six different exercise regions. Three in the south, which on the left-hand side, right-hand side, and the southern tip, and three north of the island, blockading the island during the period of the exercise, lasting for about, I think, about a week, is it? Nothing short of a week. Of course, that sent a very, very clear signal to the Taiwanese, because most of them don't want independence, because that was, as I said, threatened their livelihood, their safety. All they want is the status quo. But then the status quo has been allowed to be upset by Nancy Pelosi's visit with the connivance and acceptance of President Chai Ing-wen. And now that the region's stability, as you said, has been feels really rattled because of all these missile testing, firing missiles very close to Taiwan's waters, and some even said to fall into the economic zones in other countries, in Japan, maybe.
Thank you very much for that. Andrew Loing, independent China specialist from Hong Kong. Moving on, the UK will enter into a recession this year, and the British economy is expected to face contraction. That is according to a warning issued by the Bank of England. The bank forecasts the recession as it has raised interest rates to 1.75% in an attempt to ride out inflation. It expects the economy to shrink in the final quarter of 2022. The contraction will persist until the end of next year. According to the bank, the economic slowdown is largely blamed on soaring gas prices. The bank has made a bleak assessment, warning British consumers will have to pay £3,500 for an average energy bill in October. Predicts the hike is in energy prices will push up inflation to around 13% to the coming winter. That is while the cost of living issues have already eroded people's purchasing power. Statistics show that U.S. police officers have killed over 700 Americans in the first 7 months of the year, and, quote, 440 others will likely be killed by the end of 2022. Figures by the Mapping Police Violence database show the number of lives taken by the police is on track to break a record in a few months. While officers are blamed for fatal shootings and acts of brutality in the U.S., the increasing number of cases has dragged calls for transformative changes. In June, American officers fired 90 bullets at a 25-year-old man of color for a traffic violation. Iran's defense ministry has displayed its various products during an exhibition in Tehran titled The Defense Ministry's Capabilities in Knowledge-Based Production and Economy. Saman Khujuri reports.
Iran's defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy. The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition.
The ministry's management team has been cooperating with more than 6,000 knowledge-based companies. The localization of products, expanding in-depth knowledge and technology, and creating synergy among the relevant institutions are on the ministry's agenda. The Defense Ministry is responsible for empowering and upgrading Iran's defense industry capabilities while using its knowledge to contribute to production of non-military products.
Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states. Because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art, weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Salman Khujuri, Tehran.
Iran says the UN nuclear agency's surveillance cameras will be turned back on at its nuclear facilities only if all the accusations against the country's nuclear program are cleared. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the removed cameras had been installed voluntarily by Iran beyond the safeguards agreement. Mohammad Islami said those cameras were monitoring Iran's nuclear activities in line with the commitments the country had made under the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA. The AEOI chief said the other signatories failed to live up to their commitments under the accord. He said there was no reason for Tehran to, quote, unilaterally honor the agreement. Islami said no camera will be reinstalled unless the other parties return to their commitments and stop accusing Iran. Iran's deputy foreign minister and top negotiator has held talks in Vienna as part of negotiations to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ali Bagheri-Kani held talks with the European Union's coordinator Enrique Mora. Prior to that, he met with the Russian envoy Mikhail Ulyanov. The top Iranian negotiator is leading a delegation who arrived in the Austrian capital earlier on Thursday to resume talks to restore the pact. The JCPOA was derailed after Washington withdrew from it in 2018. The remaining parties have held several rounds of talks since April of last year, but the negotiations came to a halt in March due to what Iran calls the U.S. failure to show goodwill as well as its excessive demands. Earlier, Iranian Professor Fouad Izadi told us that he is not optimistic about the positive outcome of the JCPOA revival talks.
You know, in negotiations, we have this principle of negotiating in good faith. And if you are not negotiating in good faith, you're not going to reach any agreement. That's the basic idea. And the United States has repeatedly shown that they don't negotiate in good faith. Because when you negotiate in good faith, you try to lower tensions. You try to lower rhetoric against the other side. You try to basically find a way of reducing tensions. And when you have the United States sanctioning Iranian companies or companies that work with Iran every other day, basically, you are not negotiating in good faith. So when you're dealing with a country like that, the expectations for a successful conclusion of these negotiations are quite low. Because if the United States really wanted to return to the agreement, they could do it on the first day of the Biden presidency, the same way he returned to the Paris Climate Accord. He could issue an executive order and return.
Caracas has denounced the U.S. call for Argentina to seize a Venezuelan cargo plane grounded in Buenos Aires since June. President Nicolas Maduro says that Washington aims to steal a plane that is legally owned by Venezuela. The remarks came after the U.S. Justice Department said the aircraft being sold by Iran's Mahan Air airline to Venezuela's Emtrasur company is a, quote, unauthorized transfer. Washington says the transfer is in violation of U.S. export control laws because both airlines are under sanctions. The plane has been stuck in Argentina since June 8. On Monday, Argentina's federal judge ordered the departure of a dozen of 19 crew members, who include Iranians and Venezuelans. The order was issued after Iran summoned Argentina's envoy last week and called for the departure of its nationals. Tehran says Iranian trainers are on board the plane in accordance with international aviation regulations. Amid simmering tensions between Russia and the West, Moscow says the era of cooperation between the two is irrevocably over.
Regardless of the duration and the outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Drobinin noted that the current situation provided an opportunity to get rid of illusions and to take Russia beyond the paradigm of friendly absorption. He added that relations with North American and European countries will not return to the pre-Ukraine conflict state of affairs. tensions are running high between Russia and the West over the former's military operation in Ukraine. Since the war began on February 24th, Western countries have taken action against Russia by providing both military and financial aid to Ukraine and imposing a wave of sanctions measures against Moscow. Russia, on the other hand, has responded to those measures. UN says that warring sides in Yemen have agreed to extend a UN-brokered truce for another two-month-long period. Dr. Latif al-Washali has more.
The UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Hans Grundberg, announced that the parties to the war have agreed to extend the armistice for another 2 months under the same terms as the original agreement. The deal was reached following lengthy talks mediated by an Omani delegation between the Saudi led coalition and the Ansarullah movement. Grundberg said the extension of the ceasefire includes a commitment from the parties to intensify negotiations to reach an expanded truce agreement as soon as possible. The head of Yemen's National Negotiating Delegation Mohammed Abdel Salam thanked Oman for its efforts to find a solution for peace in Yemen. He also called on the United Nations to make more efforts to pay the suspended salaries of the employees and open Sana'a Airport and Hodeidah Port. Hours before the UN announcement, the Omani delegation left Sana'a after holding talks with senior Yemeni officials, including the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat. Neighboring Oman has been playing a key role in efforts to end the ongoing crisis and establish a process in Yemen.
Experts believe that Riyadh will seek to extend the current truce without putting an end to the years-long war in Yemen to preserve its interests in the country. They say the United Nations should take the issue of alleviating the humanitarian crisis more seriously. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see, says Hamid Dabashi, author, in an article published under the heading Western universities struggle to grow away from their racist roots. Stay tuned for more. Last April, Harvard President Larry Baikal released the report of the Committee on Harvard and Legacy of Slavery, accepted the committee's recommendations in full, and announced a historic commitment of $100 million to fund their implementation, according to a detailed internal report on the school's four-century connection to slavery. This seems to be a season of public penance for American universities as they come to terms with nasty skeletons in their closets. How can a university muster the moral authority to teach anyone anything with that kind of horrid past? The report by a committee of Harvard faculty members is Harvard's effort to begin redressing the wrongs of the past, as some other universities have been doing for decades, according to an article in the New York Times. But how exactly is this redressing to be done? When people heard John Henry Newman's lofty ideas in 1850s, later collected in the volume The Idea of a University, they might be forgiven for thinking that Europeans and Americans were truly engaged in the perfection of the human soul, and that universities were a place to cultivate young people for an upright moral life. Really? Enslaved men and women served Harvard presidents and professors in fed and cared for Harvard students. The Harvard report reveals. Was that evidence of Newman's ideas reaching the New World? The racist roots of American and European universities are being exposed, and their nasty implications in human misery publicized for the whole world to see. This is not a cause for jubilation or even for a sigh of relief that truth is finally triumphing. This is a moment for reflection and an opportunity for remedy. The structural issues, such as reports that expose for the next generations of higher education. At least since the reflections of the towering Italian thinker Antonio Gramsci, we have known that education is a solid source of cultural hegemony of the ruling class. But the relatively widespread availability of higher education and the attraction of a global body of students to US and European universities has demographically altered their compositions. A much larger and more diverse body of students, faculty, and administration is now attentive to the roots and fruits of these universities. This cycle of soul-searching began some two decades ago with Brown University examining its roots in slavery. Soon afterwards, Harvard College acknowledged it had relied on slave labor, and Princeton University admitted to holding a slave auction in 1766. At University of Columbia, sons of merchants involved in the slave trade were enrolled, while Dartmouth College admitted that at one time there had been arguably as many enslaved black people as there were students. This was at a time when University of Pennsylvania faculty and alumni were actively involved in framing the Constitution to support slavery. European universities were not exempt. Oxford began probing its own role in British colonialism in 2019 in what The Guardian described as a pioneering effort to crowdsource and decolonize its own imperialist part. This led to the establishment of an informed and informative website detailing the history of Oxford's racist roots in slavery and colonialism. These events at Oxford started with a student-led movement that originated in South Africa called Rhodes Must Fall, a reference to Cecil Rhodes, Oxford's imperialist benefactor. But Oxford ultimately decided to keep its Rhodes statue intact because it would have been too expensive to remove it. Other UK universities are equally implicated. The University of Glasgow admitted it had received more than $258 million from people who derived their wealth from slavery, while the University of Bristol estimated that 85% of the wealth used to found the university depended on slave labor, according to Reuters. On both sides of the Atlantic, U.S. and European universities were founded on the profits made from transatlantic slave trade and the lucrative business of colonialism. In these universities, the children of slave traders and colonial officers were educated, and indeed indoctrinated, in the validity of their conquest and in the political culture and moral depravity that sustained this sick tradition. What do we do now? Admitting mea culpa is, of course, necessary but not sufficient. Revelations that top American and universities in the Europe were heavily invested in slavery, benefited from the slave trade, and were institutional advocates of colonialism is a major event in the history of higher education. But what exactly needs to be done once such revelations are widely publicized? Allocation of resources to diversify the student and faculty body to include the descendants of the impoverished, robbed, and denigrated communities, Black people, Native Americans, Latins, and students and faculty from across the colonial world is, of course, an absolute must. While Western universities are today quite cognizant of the disenfranchised communities in their midst and seek to recruit more from these communities, this does not apply to students from around the world subject to their colonial and imperial violence. This is a serious shortcoming. Students and scholars from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the EU and US have been definitive to their national miseries, must be given particular attention. Today, Afghan and Iraqi students in particular need to be given financial resources for their higher education in American and European universities. But what exactly are these students and scholars to study or teach in these universities? Further indoctrination in white supremacist curricula. The urgent task of remedying the horrors of the past must include serious reconsideration of the future of college curricula. Meaningful reparations can only occur when the history of racism, slavery, and colonialism is brought to the forefront inside European and American university classrooms. But today, even the body of scholarship produced under the rubric of critical race theory or intersectionality is under attack by reactionary forces in Europe and the US. Private universities, at the mercy of political pressure, could never lead the way, except within the conservative context determined by their wealthy donors, which continue to oppose any serious curricular changes. This is where the global media is an equally, if not even more, changes. This is where the global media is an equal, if not even more crucial, public sphere where such changes can be inaugurated. Consider when the New York Times launched two crucial projects, the 1619 Project on the history of slavery and the Haiti Ransom Project on French colonialism in Haiti. To be sure, these two seminal projects are based on generations of scholarship. But such a scholarship does not easily translate into curricular changes. Western civilization continues to be the code word for the sustained indoctrination of successive generations of students who are kept critically unaware, not just of other civilizations, but also of the troubling origins of civilizational thinking. Nothing enduring or significant follows so long as we have curricular apartheid in the world, with Western civilization receiving preferential treatment and enormous resources, while other civilizations, cultures, and accompanying suffering are delegated to the poorly financed periphery. Today, issues of environmental justice, mass refugees, labor migration, and the organically changing character of world cultures are far more crucial to understand than a fake and forced emphasis on Western civilization. Today, the most racist white supremacist political movements are sustained and agitated by false assumptions about the uniqueness and superiority of Western civilization, to which elite universities remain committed. There is no redressing the sustained history of U.S. and European universities' involvement with slavery, racism, and colonialism without first dismantling its sustained ideological premise.
Hidden Files.
Well, there's a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly or indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist and professor Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison. Some have been released, and others are still incarcerated after being in prison for more than 4 decades. Now, many of these individuals were involved in revolutionary movements in the 1960s. At the time, most of the activists were teenagers or in their 20s. Imagine that. Now, they say that they were fighting against settler colonialism and oppression. Now, these individuals are elderly in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have endured many decades in prison and have spent much of their time even in solitary confinement. Many of them are ill, and lawyers have petitioned for them to be released on the basis of compassion. However, the U.S. is still adamant about keeping them behind bars. Why?
Why American authorities felt that the Black Panthers were such a threat, and the reason why the U.S. destroyed this group and many other black nationalist groups. What exactly were they demanding? They wanted freedom and the power to determine the destiny of black and oppressed communities. The group believed that self-determination was key to ending their oppression, and they wanted to control the institutions in their communities. The Black Panthers were also seeking full employment for African Americans and other people of color. Due to the fact that black communities had been exploited for hundreds of years, the group wanted an end to the theft by the capitalist system of black people. They believed that the U.S. government was racist and prevented black Americans from excelling. They demanded what was promised to them after slavery, and that was 40 acres of land and 2 mules, or the financial equivalent of it. The Black Panthers wanted decent housing for black people and other minorities. Housing which was fit to live in. And the group was also demanding that decent education be provided to black Americans. They wanted what they called true history to be taught, which meant exposing the true nature of American imperialism, as well as teaching the reality of how black Americans had been exploited and how they contributed to society. The Black Panthers were looking at many aspects of life, including health, and they wanted free health care for all black and oppressed people. And they wanted preventive medicine to be practiced in oppressed communities. One of the first demands of the Black Panthers was an end to police brutality and the murder of black people and other oppressed people inside the United States. The Black Panthers were very aware of the connection between their own oppression and the oppression of others. Thus, they wanted an end to all wars of aggression by the United States. They said the goal of these wars was to expand domination and the oppression of people around the world. The organizations wanted the freedom for all black and oppressed people being held in all U.S. prisons. The Panthers felt that to begin with, their incarceration was due to the racist and oppressive system. And they also believed that any trials held for alleged crimes should be done so in front of a jury of peers. To sum it up, what the Black Panthers wanted for their people and others were land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Had these demands been met, it would have ensured the liberation, independence, and advancement of the black community in the United States. However, the imperialist capitalist system is not designed to liberate the oppressed, but to gain the ultimate benefit from their oppression.
Well, I would like to welcome a former U.S. political prisoner to Hidden Files who was incarcerated for 49 years.
Jalil Montarem, former member of the Black Panthers Party, which he joined at 16, and founding member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. He was incarcerated at age 19, and he was freed at age 69. He spent almost 15 years in prison. He was released in October of 2020.
Jalil Muntarem established the first revolutionary newspaper from prison and continues to be active. He started From Inside Prison, a national campaign to recognize political prisoners. He also started a UN petition against the U.S. having political prisoners.
Well, thank you for joining us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Muntarem. How do you define a political prisoner?
How do we bring these categories and define who they are as a result of their resistance of being dissenters to a system of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism? For us, our comrades are freedom fighters, right? They identify them as being terrorists. Why are they terrorists? Because they're opposing the ideals and the practices of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism. Right? They are trying to alleviate our oppression, right, by any means necessary, as El Hajj Malik Shabazz has instructed us, by any means necessary. And so therefore they criminalize us, right, and bring us to criminal court in order to charge us what they call criminal offenses, right, on their books, right, in order to protect their interests, protect the state, right? And so this is the reason why they don't want to identify us as political prisoners, because they criminalize our movement. They criminalize our people. They criminalize our movement, right? We've been engaging in war against black people since 1619, all right, if you really want to understand it, all right? When they had the black codes, they had Jim Crow, right? And they have mass incarceration, right? The school-to-prison pipeline, right? It's all criminalizing our lives, right? Our efforts to be actually totally free and emancipated, right, of people. And so that is the reason why they criminalize us, don't want to give us recognition, right, and understanding that there is divisions in this country, right, as a result of white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, past and race divisions in this country, and that there are people grappling with this idea that at some point in time, we have to free ourselves from a system that has been oppressing us for the last 400 years.
Well, from your experience, do you think that political prisoners are treated differently than the average prisoner?
We find that political prisoners are naturally distinguished from the regular general prison population. And the reason why is because they're educated. They're educated and they understand the nature of their relationship to the state. And therefore, they try to remove those individuals from the population because they do not want the general population to be educated and understand what is their relationship to the state in regards to being an antagonistic relationship they have with the state, particularly based upon race and class. And so for me, naturally, being an organizer in prison, I haven't been organized outside prison, been organized inside prison, I often was targeted by prison officials to be put in solitary confinement and or have other types of harassments and being deprived of certain privileges that most prisoners get. They would deprive me of that. But the only thing that did made me stronger, made me fight harder, that's all.
Well, do you think that it has been proven to the international community that political prisoners exist in the U.S., though Washington denies it?
Excellent question. You are absolutely correct. The United States does not recognize the fact that they do have political prisoners. When I first put in my, I'll give you an example. When I first submitted my campaign, U.S. Petition campaign to the United Nations, this was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I had the opportunity to have a question asked of then UN ambassador to the United Nations by a guy named by the name of Andrew Young, the first black UN ambassador to the United Nations under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And the question I had asked him by a journalist who was, when he was in Paris having a press conference, was, does political prisoners exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered in the affirmative, positively, said perhaps thousands. You can Google New York Times, Andrew Young, political prisoners, and all those articles will come up. He was vilified in the press, vilified by the elite for having made that truthful statement that perhaps 1,000 political prisoners in the United States. And he was called to the carpet in the White House and told him to shut that down. Why do they do that? They do that because they don't want the world to know that there is dissent in the United States, right? They project themselves as being the moral humanitarian leader of the world, and that is a false. That's a falsehood, right? They are the greatest harbinger of and progeny of violence in the world. Not my words; those are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King prior to his being assassinated. He said the United States is the greatest a progenitor of violence in the world. And we understand that. We know that.
Well, do you see a connection between the oppression of Black Americans and the oppression of people worldwide?
One of the things I told the community, international community, that their freedom depends mostly on our freedom, like Black people's freedom in the United States, right? I informed them specifically that when we are free, you will be free, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because we are in the bastion of white supremacy, you see? And so for us, if this empire, what we call the United States, which is in fact is an empire, right? Well, an octopus, right? You can see the tentacles all over the world, right? Well, they're sucking the blood and sucking the resources and sucking the labor from various, particularly mostly people of color countries around the world, all right? Now, those who engage in struggles for national liberation and independence to end colonialism, neocolonialism, oftentimes they'll cut off the tentacles, right, of the octopus, right, and free themselves. But what happens? The tentacles grow back. Right? And a period of time, the tentacles grow back, like what happened in Chile and Salvador Allende, right? Mm-hmm. As an example, when Pinochet took over after they freed themselves. And the same thing happened in various other parts of the world. Why is that? Because the head has not been dealt with, the head of the octopus, right? We are in the head of the octopus, okay? So therefore, as long as the head of the octopus maintains itself, right, then they continue to create the conditions from which they can reassert themselves in those struggles, in those moves that were successful at some point in time. All right, so for us, it is imperative that the world know, that the international community, progressive international community, understands that what they're dealing with around the world is white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, but we're in the bastion, we're in the heart of it, right? We're in the belly of the beast. And therefore, our struggle, ultimately, when we are successful, inshallah, when we are successful, the world will also be free.
Well, fortunately, you are no longer in prison. But can you tell us more about the overall conditions of these prisoners, even as we speak?
Imam Jamil Al-Amin, right, who they know is innocent of the crime that he committed. But because of his history of resistance, they had to lock him in the prison system. Right? He's been in ever since, almost 22 years now. Right? They know he's innocent. The guy who committed the crime for which he was convicted of confessed, all right? But they hold him in prison because of his politics or who he is as a political person. Another individual is Varon Zambaro, right? This individual was part of Black Liberation Army, part of the movement back in the days. He did his time, was on his way out the front door, had gotten parole, had received parole on his way out the front door. And Anthony Gonzalez, who was Attorney General of the United States at the time, called the prison and told them, don't release him. He's still in prison today. Right, because of his politics, not because of anything else he's done. He did his time. He guaranteed parole, right? And they won't let him go, won't release him. Another individual, of course, is Rochelle McGee. Rochelle McGee is the oldest political person that we have in the United States today, right? And he was involved in the 1970 insurrection, August 1970 insurrection with Jonathan Jackson, George's younger brother, at the Bruin County Courthouse, right? He was found not guilty of shooting and he'd been involved in that incident. Not guilty by the court. The court would not accept that decision from the jury. Would not accept it. Right? He's still in prison today. Right? Mumia Abdul-Jamal. We know that he did not commit the crime for which he was committed. He's known around the world as a profound intellect, right? Inside prison and outside of prison, right? They know he was innocent for what he did. They won't let him out of prison. We've had comrades who died in prison on their deathbed, and they won't release it for compassionate release, so they'll be dying at home, right, because of their politics. One particularly, Mutulu Shakur, right, the stepfather of the great rapper Tupac Shakur, right, he's terminally ill today, right, he asked for compassionate release several times, and they denied him, or probably martial law, he's going to die in prison. Okay. This is how they treat us, political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Oh, really appreciate you being with us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Jalil Motaki. Now, let's take a closer look at some of the political prisoners that were mentioned by our guests.
Assata Shakur. She is the step-aunt and godmother of late rapper Tupac Shakur and the sister of political prisoner Dr. Mutulu Shakur. She is 75 years old. Under U.S. President Obama's term,
Not only was she not pardoned, but the bail on her head increased from $1 million to $2 million. Dr. Matulu Shakur. He is a doctor who specializes in acupuncture. He was very effective in helping people get off of drugs using his method. He was a black liberation activist. He's also the stepfather of rapper Tupac Shakur. He was charged and convicted for helping his sister Asata escape prison. He was eligible for parole in 2016, and despite being a model prisoner, his release has been denied. Currently, he's suffering from stage 3 bone marrow cancer, and he is 71 years old. There have been many requests made for him to be released on humanitarian reasons, but they all have been denied. Rochelle Sink McGee. Rochelle is the oldest political prisoner in the United States. He's 83 years old. He has only lived 16 years outside of prisons. The rest of his life he has spent behind bars. From the beginning, he was convicted of trumped-up charges based on racism. He says slavery 400 years ago and slavery today is the same, just with a new name. Momia Abu Jamal. Momia Abu Jamal is an internationally recognized journalist and black liberation activist. He was one of the founding members of the Philadelphia chapter of Black Panthers, and he has been known as the voice of the voiceless for his many years spent writing about issues relating to working class people of color, prisoners, and the underrepresented. He has written 8 books and countless articles and commentaries from a prison cell on death row in Pennsylvania. He has been incarcerated since 1981. He's 68 years old and suffering from various diseases. Imam Jamil al-Amin. Formerly known as H-Rap Brown, he served as Minister of Justice with the Black Panthers. He is a well-known Muslim leader now and has been in prison since 2000. He remains in jail despite another man admitting to killing the person al-Amin was accused of killing.
Over the years, there have been many political prisoners to die in prison or to be released and to die within days of their release in the United States. There are petitions and movements around the world asking for compassionate releases for these aging revolutionaries. Well, we will continue to follow it up right here and let you know about their latest situation. But for now, I'd like to leave you with this quote from journalist and political prisoner Momia Abu Jamal. Conventional wisdom would have one believe that it is insane to resist this, the mightiest of empires. But what history really shows is that today's empire is tomorrow's ashes, that nothing lasts forever, and that to not resist is to acquiesce in your own oppression. Well, the greatest form of sanity that anyone can exercise is to resist that force that is trying to repress, oppress, and fight down the human spirit. Until next time, we hope that we hear from you. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.